Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, before we start the show, I thought I'd say hello and happy new year, basically. Hopefully, Mid-Atlantic is going to go from strength to strength in 2022. We've secured somewhat of an alliance with a political operative who's a great mover and shaker in the United States. So hopefully, that will open up more influential guests and more kind of sitting politicians. But this show, I recorded about 2-3 weeks ago. And it was with Gregory Miller, who's one of the two co-founders and is the chief operating officer of the OSET Institute. Now, first off, I am working with OSET. But the reason why I thought I should quickly intro this is because the conversation didn't really turn out the way that I expected, the way that I wanted. I wanted a conversation which is going to be more about American civics and attitudes. But what OSET do is election technology, and their mission is to increase integrity, improve turnout. So the conversation kind of went down a slightly different path, and I kind of felt somewhat underprepared for the way that the conversation went. I think it's a great conversation, it's an enjoyable show, but I just wanted to be honest and hold my hand up and say that what I had in mind isn't exactly the way the conversation went. This is definitely a conversation about Americans talking about civic engagement, but it's less about why America has, let's say, the attitudes that it has around governance, and more specifically about voter integrity and the vote. So there you go. It's a great conversation. This is me speaking to Gregory Miller and the massed ranks of Mid-Atlantic folk on Clubhouse. Enjoy.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Brexit means Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you are. This is Mid-Atlantic. My name is Roy Ford Brown and I'm sat in a rather wet London. And today I'm going to be speaking to Gregory Miller of OSET, or the Trust the Vote organization, to talk about how exactly does American democracy work. And if we're to believe anything in the last year, many Americans believe that dead men actually do vote. So we're going to ask Gregory Miller of the OSET Institution why so many Americans have that fallacy. Gregory, welcome to the stage. How are you today, sir?
Great, thanks, and glad to be here.
Simple question for us in the rest of the world. Greg, has there been a year since the end of the Civil War which has been so consequential to American democracy? It felt on January the 6th that potentially the country that lauds itself as being the most stable in the world was heading towards some form of coup d'etat. Is that hyperbole on my part? Was that the rest of the world not quite understanding the situation that happened on the Capitol? And before you answer the question, I'd like to take us back to a report on CBS on January the 6th.
push people back, hold them back, and arrest them. They did seem to be arresting some, but they no longer have been able to keep them back. You can see some Capitol Police officers and protesters up there waving for more. If you look just right next to me, there is a massive amount of what appears to be blood on the ground here. At least one person over here is being injured and taken away. Yeah, as more and more people make their way towards the step and push through, as I was watching this saying, it looks like people are being arrested. One woman came up to me and she said that this is what happens when they believe that there have been what they believe are fraud in the election, and told me these are people standing up for America.
Gregory, were those protesters rioters, insurrectionists, choose the word, or patriots, choose whichever word that you want, were they standing up for America and American democracy?
Apologies for a moment there, Roy Field. I literally had to recompose myself after listening to that excerpt. I'm having an emotional moment here. It's hard, very hard to hear. That day will go down as a blight on this great American experiment of representative democracy. So I have to say that I have some guardrails here because, as you may know, at the OSINT Institute, some of us are still detached to the national security apparatus on various aspects of election security and related matters. So there are things that I won't be able to talk about too much in depth. But I can go up to that guardrail repeatedly, and here's the first step. No, in no shape or form whatsoever were the individuals who were responsible for that insurrection reflecting the tenor of America and our attitude towards the election process, the peaceful transfer of power, or any of it. Just not so. Yes, there is a tremendous issue in this country with whether or not there's trust in the vote, but not to the level that was created by that event.
I've always been really struck in my kind of studying of American democracy and American elections, that you get what's trumpeted out after every election is the peaceful transfer of power. And I must admit, as a Brit, I kind of somewhat bristle, as if to say, well, you're hardly unique in that, America. Swedish elections can go left and right, and there's always a peaceful transfer of power, let alone British ones. Do we seriously now, after what's happened this year, not take that as a given that the loser in an American election will actually gracefully step aside for the incumbent to take up the position?
Well, Lord only hopes that that we never witness what we witnessed on January 6th again with regard to the administration of our democracy. No, it is not a foregone conclusion that that there won't be objections and problems. Unfortunately, I think there's a new reality here, which is that elections are not to be trusted, and we've got to find a way to try to cure that. I mean, let's remember that this was the result of one of the most successful misinformation campaigns in history. We're certain that certain foreign nationals and others were gloating over the success of this, right? We had a nation hoodwinked. So I think that there's going to continue to be that problem. And no, it's not a foregone conclusion. Things will transfer peacefully. In fact, I think we're gritting quite seriously for what's coming this midterm cycle, starting in just a few days, and certainly 2024.
This is what's happened this year, but let's kind of go back. You have a reason for why you set up OSET and why Trust the Vote means so much to you. But let's go back and try and quickly plot out your story and the reason why this means so much to you. So your parents escaped from Germany just before the start of the Second World War.
You are going to make this an emotional engagement today, aren't you? I am the son of Holocaust survivors, not the grandson, not the second cousin, but my parents, for different reasons. My father's family was Jewish, my mother's family was Catholic. And for those of you who are students of that history, you recognize that at some point Catholics were no more safe than anyone else. If you weren't Ein Protester, then you were in trouble. Yes, both of my parents managed, by the grace of God, to escape Germany in 1938 and 1939, respectively, late parents, I should point out by now. And I wouldn't be here had they not found a way to get here. You can imagine that every time I hear America First as a slogan that the prior administration thought was so clever, how I bristled at that, because Charles Lindbergh and others in our history had no interest in any refugees coming to this country in that time period, and especially Jewish people from Europe. So the fact that my parents were able to get in because of prior relationships and other things was good, but many of them did not make it out. A good portion of my father's family ended up ultimately in Nuremberg. So democracy means an awful lot, meant an awful lot to my family. My late brother served in the military, in the Navy, Marines, two tours of duty in Vietnam. My father, so happy to be here and so much wanting to be a part of the fabric of this nation, dedicated his career, much of it to as an NG, part of the NGO operations in the naval shipyards, as a machinist and a mechanical engineer. My mother was a mathematician and cryptographer, a German mathematician cryptographer, no less, who found herself in Bremerton, Washington, with the same crew of people who were working on decoding the Pacific Theater the night before Pearl Harbor. So we have a long history of the importance of our democracy and sustaining it, and that has given me purpose.
Is it possible, Greg, to separate, do you think, support for Madisonian democracy from being just an American? Because as I kind of hinted at before, as much as I'm fascinated by America and its ideals of citizenship, they are atypical throughout the world. You know, I'm British, I'm English. There is no British constitution. There are no guiding principles of how Britain governs itself. Ditto the Dutch, the Norwegians, the Italians, etc. The possible exception in the Western world, the possible exception is France. You know, there are some French ideals of the French Republic. Can you be an American, a good old patriotic American, and basically not believe in Madisonian democracy? Is that possible?
I have to say, I honestly don't know at this point. This has become a bit of a blur for me, and I have to point out that, you know, although I'm an engineer with legal training and you know, a student of the Constitution to a certain extent, I can't profess to be a constitutional lawyer. I can't profess to be a civics expert, or really, as much as I would love to dive into to comparative structures between the various democracies across the globe. Our mission at the OSA Institute is global in nature, but parliamentarian democracies are considerably different than the balkanized by design system here. To be an American is compelled upon us to have an appreciation for the principles, if you will, that were set forth from the Declaration of Independence on into the Constitution. Sadly, through political maturations, that educational component has been stripped from our public education system here in the United States, such that it is absolutely shocking to me to see today the average citizen's understanding of how things work compared to those of us who were in preparatory school in the 70s. It's nutty. People do not understand how things work here, and that is in large part an ingredient to why we have the problems we have, I fear.
Do you believe then that some of the disinformation that the American public has been fed, that, you know, dead men are voting, that ballot boxes have been stuffed, et cetera, or ballots have not been counted, that a good dose of civics is what, let's say, the next generation of Americans need? Is it as simple as that?
But I'm not sure. It's not exclusively that, right? But that's a very important base ingredient to solving the problems. People have to understand how things work and don't work, so that they can come to realize that on rare occasion a dead man may vote. And I can give you some really good examples of why that can accidentally happen, even in the limited 4 cases that were found recently in one state. But that ballots don't find their way over to Spain or Germany for manipulation and return to the United States, right? That's nonsense. So I think that a civics education has to be restored in this country, and part of it is just simply understanding
how America votes. And I don't mean politically, campaign wise. I mean, what is the mechanics of how that process works here? Two articles and seven amendments to the U.S. Constitution make it very clear that elections are entirely a state's matter. And that's the first step to understand a whole host of how things work and why the system is so balkanized by design, why it can be that in 3,300 counties across 50 states and five territories that there are 10,000 elections jurisdictions and every single one of them has a slightly different way of doing things.
And is that a strength of the system or an inherent weakness?
Subject matter of great debate here stateside. It depends upon how you view things, right? If federalism courses your veins, then you may have a very strong opinion about that. We think there's at the OSA Institute, we believe there's probably a necessary balance that has to occur. In other words, when it is said that there is a state's right and a federal interest, what's been lost in this discussion is what is the legitimate federal interest, and there is one. And of course, it's in the outcomes of federal offices, the president and Congress. So I think that a couple of things. One, as much as we would love to see a federalized system of casting and counting ballots, as we see in other parliamentary democracies, where the process and the machinery and everything else is far simpler, the necessary complications of the state distribution means that there's going to have to be some balance between how the two sides agree and how this should work.
You told us about your personal kind of family story, and you more than just hinted at the reasons why shoring up, helping American democracy is important to you. But can you take us back to, let's say, the year or two before you actually founded OSET? What were you doing and what happened? What was the catalyst for you to say, I need to be a bulwark against threats to American democracy?
Well, sure. I was at the time a blue-blooded capitalist working within the ecosystem of venture capital and venture investing, having had a three-decade career in technology as an engineer and product manager and marketing executive. For many of the brands we all know, right? Apple, Netscape Communications, the Mozilla, Sun Microsystems, et cetera, was just content over there. Quite frankly, had a fair salary and enjoyed the opportunity to participate in that ecosystem in advancing innovation, believing in capital markets, et cetera, considering myself at the time to be fiscal conservative, a social progressive, then tending towards center right. And it was quite an accident, quite by accident, that we founded this project in November of 2006. It was just after the midterms there and all the mess in Cuyahoga County, Ohio, and et cetera, and a lot of question about why the voting machinery that we had turned to following what I call the Chad Fest of 2000 in Bush v. Gore in Florida, why we had done nothing to improve upon hanging chads, right? Why were these computers so sloppy and ridiculously vulnerable, et cetera, et cetera? That happened at about the same time that we were looking at how you disintermediate markets and how do you improve market performance. We were actually, literally, I was doing a brown bag lunch colloquium at a firm that I was working in. And we were looking at a project, technology project, around the notion of federated identities. Bear in mind, this was 2006, and look at where we are today. Another entire episode. Bottom line is that in the course of looking at market disintermediation and market, malformation and why markets don't perform well, the market for voting machinery, it was November just before American Thanksgiving, was the perfect poster child for that discussion. And that's when we discovered that there was a ginormous problem brewing in 2006. At the time, there were 8 or 9 major vendors of voting systems. Today, 3 vendors control 90% of America's voting infrastructure and 75% of the global infrastructure. We predicted there would be 4 by 2016. We're at 3 now, and one of them is on the edge. So at the time, what we said was, there's got to be a way to fix this, but it turned out that there wasn't a viable commercial way to do so.
So initially, what you guys were responding to wasn't necessarily a threat to the precepts of American democracy. This was the fact that
there were questions around tabulation of votes. Would that be a simple layman's, I'm an Englishman in London trying to understand exactly what you were responding to back then?
Yeah, initially the problem was that the casting and counting of ballots were being conducted on computers that were producing erratic results that immediately people were suspicious of, right? So we thought, well, surely there ought to be a venture who can build a better voting machine. I mean, we were coming out of Apple, right, and Netscape. We knew a thing or two about building product. We said, why is this? Why is this? And we turned out, we figured out right away that elections systems and technology are literally a backwater of government IT, an inherently partisan backwater that nobody wants to deal with until they absolutely have to. That seemed untenable to us because we immediately recognized, well, wait a minute, this is critical democracy infrastructure you're talking about. Why is it a backwater of government IT? Why does nobody care about it? And why are we using such, you know, shoddy equipment?
Again, the basis of this show is to compare and contrast. And I have never heard in all of my 53 years on this planet of being an Englishman, anybody talk about election software or there to be any question that that the vote is the vote in the United Kingdom. I've never heard of that. And with just a cursory knowledge of other Western Europeans, how they go about conducting their democracies, whether it's Sweden or Norway or Germany or Italy, I cannot think of political parties of candidates trying to sue or say they're going to sue the result of a local election. What is so peculiar about America that we know the names of organizations that tabulate this stuff, like Dominion was a company which I'd never heard of 4 years ago or so. But what is so peculiar about American democracy that the names of these companies that do what you do are now actually out there? And doesn't that display a weakness and a fragility in American democracy and its process of actually how it goes about trusting each other?
I won't attempt to deny that the current infrastructure doesn't make for a very trustworthy environment. The peculiarity here really boils down to the simple fact that we are a nation of impatience with some constitutional mandates and limitations about when that orderly transfer of power must occur. Our Constitution doesn't allow for what we call a mulligan or a do-over. With absolute certainty and a great deal of precision and provisions, that orderly transfer on the 20th of January, you know, has to occur. And so there's only so much time between the day of elections in November and that point to properly count, tabulate, canvass, certify, verify and certify the results. And then because we have this layer called an electoral college, for the states to determine their electors and then send them to Congress and go through the pomp and circumstance of all that. The bottom line is that you take a state like California, where we originated, you have 35 million ballots that you have to count in the course of 12 to 24 hours, not including absentee ballots and et cetera, mail-in ballots from overseas for military, et cetera. And you recognize very quickly that while you can have hand-marked ballots, that inevitably the counting of those ballots is going to require some machinery. Now, it turns out there's a lot of mechanization and automation to other parts of the ecosystem of election administration. We're just focusing on merely the counting of ballots at the moment. It's that machinery that performs the what we call the tally and then tabulation of the votes that becomes the focus of concern. That's what I think is peculiar about our system. And in other systems, you can hand count those ballots and go through that process, and you don't have those time barriers. And if you have a problem, right? I mean, imagine America trying to call a snap election.
Let's take a moment to basically remind everybody that this is a recording of the podcast Mid-Atlantic. There are literally hundreds of these episodes. If you go to a podcatcher of your choice, if you're in the audience, why don't you go and do that whilst also clicking on the little green icon and becoming a member of the Mid-Atlantic Club, which means that whenever we go live with these recordings, which are generally Tuesdays, Wednesdays, or Thursdays, you can be alerted. And then you can also be part of the conversation and the debate. I'm going to open things up. I've been somewhat scatterbrained with my questions to Gregory Miller. But Eric Foster, you're a man who thinks very, very deeply about American civics and democracy. Welcome. Do you have a question for Gregory Miller?
Well, thank you, Roy Field. Thank you, Gregory. I appreciate you being here and doing the things that you're doing. I do have a question and point to ask for your feedback on. The point for asking feedback on is survey after survey shows demonstratively that 90 to 96% of Biden voters have confidence and trust the results of what happened in 2020 and in elections in general in terms of the results. And 60 to 70% of third party voters have that same feeling. When we discuss the issue of trusting the election process and not trusting the results, do you think we're forgetting, well, my point is, I think we're forgetting that Biden voters and third party candidate voters do trust the process, and we're speaking to a subset of voters who don't, and it makes it seem like it's everybody when it's just that subset. But then another question, Gregory, to tie into that, voting is not a constitutionally guaranteed right in America. And cases from Bush v. Gore to U.S. v. Harris to Minor versus Haberset have cited that in the Supreme Court rulings, that the right to vote is not a grant of citizenship, but it is a grant of the determination of how the states will regulate it, and that it just can't be discriminated against. What role do you think that plays in the current manipulation battle that we're facing with respect to elections, voting, and who can vote and have their vote counted equally in upcoming elections?
Thank you for your question. I'm going to take the position based on what we've been doing here for 15 years that you're right. It is an implied right at best within the Constitution federally. That notion amongst a portion of the population does indeed guide, control their thinking about accessibility to the ballot. Yeah, I like to say there's sort of three types of people in this ecosystem of the political world that I really struggle to stay away from and just focus on the machinery that facilitates that democracy administration, but recognize I can't avoid it altogether. In my experience, there's three types. There are those who are guided by their ideology. There are those who are driven by their ideology. And there are those who are absolutely blinded by their ideology. And I think that you and I could come up with great examples of politicians on both sides, on all sides of the spectrum, who fit those three categories. It's not exclusive, but it tends to be a helpful general sort of partitioning of things. And I think that we are being overwhelmed by a vocal minority right now as to the trust in the vote. I have to say that our research sounds like similar, but maybe a little different in that we're finding that there is a great deal of distrust, not just in the results, but in the process on both sides. In this country, if you're on one end of the political spectrum, you're absolutely convinced there's voter fraud. If you're on the other end of the political spectrum, you absolutely are convinced that there's ballot fraud. Turns out from our position that we all agree on something. There's questions about integrity of the system. And so we ought to do things to ensure verifiability, accuracy, security, and transparency in both the process and the product, if you will. And I think that the whole misinformation, disinformation thing, not to just find a scapegoat, the enormous power of the propaganda machine made possible by the internet, where today a lie can circle the globe before the truth can find the keyboard, has aggravated and amplified this problem to such an extent now that I think there's a lot of confusion amongst a lot of folks. I mean, we conduct surveys and we collaborate with other organizations more qualified than us on this aspect of the civics engagement part of it. And we find that in certain age groups, there is complete detached disinterest with the whole process, believing that none of it matters, which is horrible.
In your polling going forward, if you all can add into your question sets for Biden and voters who pick third party candidates, because to me, those are really the true independent voters, mm-hmm. with respect to their concern and trust in process, is it a trust in the vote total, which I don't think it is, but is it a trust in the administration, which would then lead to a distrust in what the Republicans are trying to do to change the administration process? Mm-hmm. And one other question, do you think that if we actually did what the spirit of the 14th and 15th Amendments were meant to do, which in writing the congressional members wanted it to make citizenship and voting to be tie barred as a right of citizenship, so then the federal government could have more direct role to standardize the administration. Do you think that if we made voting a right of citizenship, that that would help us in addressing some of the disconnect and disparaging outcomes in administration?
Yeah, I'll just take the latter. The latter is, you and I absolutely agree on that. You know, I'm not in a position to affect legislation and whatnot. You know, we're sort of, as a 501c3 nonprofit, we're there as subject matter experts to help Congress understand the ins and outs of technology policy. But I will tell you that I completely agree with you from the standpoint of citizenship and there being an absolute essential ingredient of that as a right to cast a ballot. To the former point, I'm going to leave it to Royfield to connect us up offline here, because I would love to engage with you in working on that problem of getting at this information. We've worked with various institutions before, you know, Tufts, Georgetown, Stanford, etc. I am always hungry for data, because the data is what drives the work here to build a more public and transparent election technology infrastructure.
Eric, thank you for a fantastic volley of first questions from people on stage. Quick question, Greg. You've talked about civics and the lack of civics within American schools. It's surely one of the major structural problem, though, with this lack of trust with the whole process is the fact, as Eric said, is that you have one main party, of which a significant proportion of them doesn't trust the system if their man or woman doesn't win. Surely the efforts to go and bolster, reaffirm the solidity, the rigidity of American democracy lies intellectually there with that one party and the fact that a significant proportion of its voters are just distrustful, as opposed to let's say sitting little boys and girls down and giving them a civics lesson when they're about 14.
Yeah, so I think I understand the tenor of your question, and I struggle here because my job is to remain as nonpartisan as possible, right? Given the role of my organization and whatnot. So anytime I'm speaking on a public platform, especially one as visible as this, I have to constrain myself to not allow myself to take a partisan view of this. I will say that one of the great struggles here in America appears to be around the control and dissemination of knowledge, right? One political party prides itself in managing or trying to overmanage the administration of books and what are students allowed to read and see and et cetera, while another group wants to, you know, continually expand that, one group wants to contract that. So there is this ongoing sort of battle at the base here of knowledge and access to it, and that becomes a bit of a problem, right? So you think about wanting to restore civics education in the high schools, and the question immediately is going to come up is whose version, right? What is going to be included or excluded from that? I mean, look at the terrifying problems we have now with certain groups wanting to not even be willing to talk about unfortunate portions of our history and our past for fear that it's going to bend or distort someone's mind or belief in something. So the problems here are very complex, and I feel completely overwhelmed by trying to address them in any competent manner in this forum, other than to say that I continue to believe that there needs to be an objective level of education. You know, what's really crazy, and I'll just leave it at this, is you would be shocked to know how many Americans cannot pass the U.S. citizenship test.
I want to talk to that because my brother teaches middle school civics in New Jersey, and he feels almost always defeated by the fact that the students that he teaches are plain old middle class students. They're not poor, but they're just plain old students. Their parents don't vote. I mean, we're talking as though everything was a matter of the fight between the parties right now and the fact that one party doesn't trust elections. 50% of America doesn't vote. They don't think that the federal government applies to them or affects them. And when they send their kids to school, they don't expect that their kids are going to be taught anything that has to do with voting. They want their kids taught skills to get a job. We're so far removed in this little ivory tower that is Clubhouse from what is actually going on the ground. Some parent with two jobs who doesn't vote herself and doesn't have a father in the house is sending her kid to school, not even caring what that kid is learning, as long as the hours can fit into the hours that she has to work her job. And this is the biggest problem that we have. The parent is apathetic about voting and thinks the system is either rigged or irrelevant. And it almost doesn't matter which. My brother gave up a lucrative career to go do this because he thought he could really help. He's now been teaching civics for 10 years. He thinks he may be affected two kids out of all the kids that he's had, you know, got really interested and decided to do something about the American government. So, I find it distressing to talk partisan politics when so many people are not even at the point where they even know two parties are out there.
Well, thank goodness for those two kids. Royfield, I would have to say that one of the things I think is very important is to remember that all politics are local and have to be local. And the process of participating in elections, sure, there's this all the energy goes into the president and Congress and all of that. But I think it is really good for us to think locally and think about the importance of voting just for our local leaders and our local questions and contests. Those are the things that directly impact us, and it starts with understanding what the impact is to us, you know, there, and then maybe moving from there up. Thank goodness that he is teaching civics and attempting to. One of the things that we try to, and we recognize as a challenge in the work that we do to build better technology, is that voting isn't just about members of Congress and the President of the United States, right? It's all the way down to your local elected officials, your school boards, your utility boards, who's on the water board, who's on the sewer. I'm hoping that there can be some emphasis placed on the locality of politics and the necessity to look at that. I mean, one political party in this country has done a really grand job of doing that, right? And we have to ensure that all parties are doing a great job of instilling the necessity to look locally first.
Or that it's nonpartisan. You know, I've lived in Arizona for over 50 years, and it's a very Republican state. And yet the local politics of my city are nonpartisan. The Phoenix mayoral race is nonpartisan. The city council race is nonpartisan.
And same true in Portland, Oregon for us. I agree with you.
So it's only when you get up higher to the governor and the Senate and the presidency that Arizona gets crazy. It's never crazy at the local level.
Right.
Thank you, Dr. Francine. Greg Sattell.
Hi, Gregory. I didn't realize this until the session started, but I interviewed for you for a Forbes article back in 2013, so close to a decade ago. And in that conversation, you outlined four challenges. The first was balkanization of standards. The second was data formatting. The third was fostering interstate cooperation. And the fourth is achieving scale, especially when, you know, it needs to, you know, a startup like Facebook can sort of move fast and break things, but with voting technology, you certainly can't. So in the almost 10 years that have gone by, how much progress have we made in each of those, in any of those four areas?
Mr. Saddle, I'm smiling broadly because I remember that interaction with you, and I certainly appreciate you returning and your questions. Because there has been considerable update in a decade's worth of work. I will tell you that with regard to standards, open data standards, open software standards, that has progressed, albeit with a lot of kicking and screaming and dragging people forward. But work has managed to progress with the National Institute of Standards and Technology and the United States Election Assistance Commission. With regard to interstate cooperation, boy, there's been tremendous advance there. We've done so much work with voter registration systems and the ability to improve upon reconciliation of data between states to try to minimize the terrible and wrongful removal of people from the records, and the rightful removal when they literally did pass away. So we've made great progress there. I think we still have a long way to go with regard to systems certification processes and the model for how that occurs, so that we can get a faster life cycle of technology and we can innovate more quickly. But there too, we've made some advances that are probably worth discussing further.
We're going to jump to Andrea. Andrea, you run a very kind of successful club on Clubhouse, which kind of looks at the participation that Americans should have with the American system. So, Andrea, do you have a question?
I do. It's Royfield. It's also kind of cross-partisan, cross-race, building bridges, civic engagement, in a way trying to model what we think some of the change needs to be in democracy and giving calls to action. But the question I guess I have for Gregory is, if you could do the most impactful thing to strengthen democracy, let's just start right here in the United States, what would it be?
You're only going to allow me one.
Sorry.
Right. No, I understand. But if I'm constrained to one and I'm forced to pick, struggling with this, automatic voter registration, I'll pick that as a first one. That would be something that would be a key to helping. So I'll go with that. There are many things, but I'll say let's start there.
Andrew, thank you for a very succinct question, and ditto Gregory for a very succinct answer. Roger, you're up next, sir.
Awesome. Thanks. So the tone of this conversation is that we should trust the vote. And I even heard some stats around, like, you know, certain demographics trust it more than others. I'll just make this bold statement. We shouldn't trust the vote. And the reason we shouldn't trust the vote is not simply because of what's happening at the ballot box. It's the way that we structure all of the election processes, from the CPD, the Commission on Presidential Debates, which are designed to force third parties out of the process. That is not democratic. When we look at the evidence of intervention in foreign elections, and I don't mean Russians interfering in our elections, we've interfered. The U.S. government has interfered 81 times in foreign elections. So we actively participate in covert and overt election tampering. And so we should absolutely expect that others would want to do it to us. And so my question is, why are we pussyfooting around this issue and acting like, oh, this is an education issue in civics? It's not. It's an example of the fact that we're ignoring that there is rampant corruption within our federal government, and all of the parties, you know, that step forward, whether we're talking about the political parties, whether we're talking about the 501Cs, whether we're talking about private donors, they're all complicit in this, and we're acting as if it's a civics exercise. If we're going to ignore that there's corruption, I think this conversation's pretty bogus.
Well, I'm going to step up and agree with you straight up, and I'm going to recommend that people go look up a video entitled Unbreaking America, Solving the Corruption Crisis by Jennifer Lawrence. 12 minutes and 36 seconds of very well spent time on YouTube and elsewhere. I'm stumping for her, but it's worth it because you just nailed something that's really important and central, and I invite you to take a look at that. You'll find that even in Jennifer's presentation, masterfully done, there still is an educational component of making people aware of what these problems are, because you're absolutely right. I think that, as I understand it, this was structured around the notion of civics and civic participation because, that is, for us, that is the issue. There's a lot more to the issue about trusting the vote than civics education, to be sure, a lot more. But with regard to participation and what influences participation, I think I understood that that's kind of the direction that Royfield was taking. And so when we think of that, we do think about, do people even understand how this process works? You're expanding upon that in a very important way, which is not just, you know, how does the system work, but what are the factors in the system that are broken and really giving rise to this? You know, we could get into a whole discussion about the Electoral Count Act of 1877 and 1887 and realize that structurally we have problems at the very base of all of this. But you're spot on, man.
Yeah, and just to back that up, Roger, I did say to Gregory that fundamentally, we are going to talk about civics. We can go layer after layer within the structure of American democracy, and fundamentally, we would not do it justice if we're going to have questions from the audience, if we're going to try and fit that into an hour. So I gave Gregory a very limited remit here, which I thought he could speak knowledgeably and well about, considering his own kind of background as the reason why he set up OSET. So thank you for the question, though, Roger. But we did try and keep it narrow to at least get it all within an hour. I'm going to throw this out to Justin Higgins. Justin Higgins, you're up next, sir.
Royfield, my good friend. So I just have two quick comments. Not really sure if I have a question. I'm a little confused with the narrative of the show, because if you look at vote turnout in 2020 alone, it's the highest it's been in over 100 years in the United States. And then if you look at our art and our culture, politics and civic duty has clearly come to front of mind from 2016 forward. So I'd argue that there has been a great reawakening in civics. And then the next thing that I'd just like to add is, you know, I've worked in Congress. I've been a consultant embedded in CISA. If we're talking about election integrity, I think it's a good thing that Americans know the different voting systems, because that initially started from investigative journalism, CBS and other outlets, bringing up legitimate security concerns. Are these voting machines attached to the internet in a way that foreign countries can interfere in our system? Some of them were, especially in specific counties in Florida. So I think ultimately it's not like Americans don't trust. It's that maybe a little bit differently than the UK culture, which has very strict libel laws and less freedom of speech as defined by our government, the United States and Americans require and demand more transparency. And that's just another security check on its own. And then lastly, from working in CISA, if we wanted to do something to strengthen the integrity of our elections, and we only could do one thing, it would be paper ballots, so that we're not just going off of these mechanical vote counts, and we actually have the hardcore physical paper ballots to go through, and if necessary, do a full recount to ensure that we weren't hacked. So those are my three quick points, Royfield. Love the show. Thank you for having me.
Gregory, just before you answer, because I think the first question was kind of directed at me and kind of the ethos of the show. The largest turnout in 100 plus years, more Americans voted in the last election, the last general election, than ever before. Utter facts. Also, January the 6th did happen, and I don't have the ready statistics in front of me, but as a percentage, more Americans are distrustful with the mechanics of how American democracy now works in terms of its election outcomes. This is a relatively new phenomena. Yes, we're hanging chads in 2000, but those amount of Americans who are skeptical about the whole system, with each election, it seems to rise. And this isn't mirrored in other industrialized democracies. We don't have people within the United Kingdom who are for whatever reason, and I'm utterly here open, and I will say that I do not necessarily know the answer. We don't have people in the United Kingdom who are distrustful of the results of the tabulations. We just don't. Ditto in every other industrialized democracy. So that's the reason why I thought it'd be great to have Gregory on to kind of talk about some of these issues around how votes are counted, the mechanisms. But there is a step behind that, which is why are so many Americans now questioning the efficacy of the results. Gregory, over to you.
Thanks, Royfield. And I'll only add to the remarks that the durable paper ballot of record is the predominant mechanism by which we cast and count ballots today. There are ballot marking devices which produce paper. There are issues with those devices. We've written about that extensively on our website. But the durable paper ballot of record is and shall be for the foreseeable future the way that we get this done. It is the currency of democracy, right? The ballot is our currency of a democracy. And so the ability to understand voter intent, the ability to recount. I mean, we're big proponents of risk-limiting audit technology. You can't do risk-limiting audits if you don't have paper ballots to count. So make no mistake, we're huge supporters of the paper ballot of record and systems that produce and ensure the provenance and integrity and stewardship of those ballots. So I think, you know, I'm in agreement with you on that point.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Aaron Berger.
Thank you, Royfield, and good to see a lot of familiar friends here. Gregory, good to meet you as well. My question here, you know, we're talking about election security here. By many accounts, the last election was the most secure that we've had possibly in the history of this country. Over 60 lawsuits that were adjudicated upon that found no fault. We've had multiple recounts that have found no fault, yet we still have a rather significant amount of Americans who seem to have curiosity that I am hard to, it's difficult to me to see that curiosity satiated unless they win. In your research, have you found methods or things that could be agreed upon that would begin to restore back to levels that we had seen leading up to turn of this century, a restoration of the trust? I'm not saying that we all have to think it's important, of course, to be able to challenge things, certainly, but I think that the response to what I've seen, the unnecessary response to 2020 here, just seems to have this strange curiosity behind it. Thank you.
boy, there's a lot there to unpack, and all of it important. And you know, again, I'm going to say that we've written about this extensively within our blogs at osedinstitute.org. Let me just say this with regard to the securest election ever. So, being part of various national security teams working on election security, I've been exposed to a considerable amount there, and I have to say that that may have been an unfortunate title that people took and ran with. Yes. The election was one of the most secure we've had, but that was a statement made by a group who gave that assessment that CISA underwrote and took forward, and it was a bit myopic in the sense that they were looking at certain indicators that told them the probability of success in security, such as the deployment of Albert sensors to look for nefarious activities on networks. For certain aspects of the election administration ecosystem that had nothing to do with ballot counting and casting. But by and large, it was the most secure. And there were 5 dozen lawsuits that showed that the challenges made no sense. They were nonsensical challenges. Here's what happened there real quickly. Unfortunately, there's a scintilla of truth to the insecurity, the inherent insecurity of the infrastructure itself. And these individuals took that scintilla of truth, wrapped it with a bunch of disinformation and created just enough to get people confused as to what really happened. The scintilla of truth is this, and the reason we exist. There is an inherent vulnerability in the design and execution of voting machinery today. That's an irrefutable problem, that these machines are inherently modifiable. Whether or not the radio card is activated, you have an internet connection through Wi-Fi, or whether or not you do any of that, if you have a machine that has a port that allows you to use removable media, a USB data stick, something like that, the machine is inherently modifiable, and nobody with a straight face can tell you that it's possible to prove that hardware hasn't been modified. Another subject for another time to go very much deeper into, but that is the inherent problem, and so a lot of the work that we're doing is to modify that. As to things that parties have come to agree with in a bipartisan fashion, one thing for sure is recognizing that so long as innovation amounts to a guarantee of spare parts in this country for these election machines, and that's true, then one of the things we need to do is tighten down and securify our supply chain of those spare parts. That's something that we've witnessed bipartisan support for. We've witnessed bipartisan support for transparency and for verifiability, accuracy, and security, the 4 components of what's called the VAST mandate, that which indicates a trustworthy election has occurred. And how are those being manifest? Well, paper ballots of record, risk-limiting audits. We're going to see in this next election cycle that post-election audits are greatly formalized and some normalcy is restored to that process.
Thank you for that question and answer. Ben, you're up next, sir.
Thank you, Roy Phil. I know that you had actually answered part of my question already earlier. And I was going to ask about the For the People Act, which is being held ransom by Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. Assuming that we can get past the filibuster and knowing that it's already been watered down, my sense is that it's probably going to be watered down some more before they vote for it. What elements within the For the People Act are absolutely necessary, do you think, as opposed to the ones that we could take care of later?
As you know, that the acts as originated in the House and then over the Senate are really more like omnibus bills for matters of elections. So there is, we've got 2 folks on our government relations team right now that are plying through the 900 pages to get very clear on each and every element and what should, what may go, what may be salvaged. So, that cutting room floor exercise, we're underway on right now, and I don't have any good news for you on it yet. I can tell you that philosophically for us, a few things matter to us, at least at the OSA Institute. We think automatic voter registration is very important. We think vote by mail is important. There's no one way to cast a ballot these days, despite the dominance of the in-person polling place experience. Pandemics aren't going away. Climate change isn't going away. There'll be another Superstorm Sandy. We're going to have exigent circumstances that require people an alternative way to get a ballot cast. So I think that elements of absentee voting, vote by mail, automatic registration are really, in our minds, critical. We have a little stupid, silly behind baseball thing. We want to see the critical infrastructure designation codified in 3USC and taken out as an agency designation within the Department of Homeland Security, because agency designations can be given and taken away at the whim of a subsequent administration. But by codifying it, then we're going to create a whole set of circumstances where we can guarantee ongoing funding for the election security, for election training, et cetera. So those are some of our big things that we think are essential. Now, if we were to drift out of our lane, of course, there are all kinds of other questions that we think need to be answered, going back to one of the great ones, which is the notion that voting is a right of citizenship. Out of scope, out of my lane, above my pay grade, all of that.
Thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you, Ben Mendelsohn. I'm just quickly looking at the stage, and I think the only person who hasn't actually asked the question, and if I'm incorrect, is you, Emic Tremaita, and you were the first person in the room. So, Eric, do you have a question? And if so, ask it and make sure it's a doozy.
No pressure. My question is, why can't we just vote by smartphone? You know, I can do my banking. My distillery can do millions of dollars in transactions very securely through smartphone. What are the specific things that are keeping this technology from being used on a state-by-state basis?
Well, it's a great question, and I will tell you, thank you for asking. We get that asked a lot of us. We've written a lot about this. It requires pawing through our blogs and our research pages at osetinstitute.org. We are 75 people here, of which 42 are research engineers, hardware, software, firmware. I will tell you up front, we are not huge supporters of smartphone voting at this stage in life, with the internet as we know it and smartphones as we know it. That said, in fairness of full disclosure, so real quickly again, I want to say that we are conducting research and development work now on absentee ballot marking systems that work in a mobile setting that currently produce a paper ballot for submission. But over time, there's a possibility, and work should continue to explore this. The things that really block us right now today, and most important, a voting transaction is not a banking transaction. They are two very different transactions, for the simple reason that we have this notion of non-repudiation, right? So in a situation of a financial transaction, I can always back it out, right? I can always say, no, I didn't do that. In elections, we have a big, big challenge in the United States. We have the notion of the very important notions of the secrecy of the ballot and the anonymity of the voter. So unlike a financial transaction, it is, I cannot ever link you to a specific ballot transaction, right? So that's the first problem, is the non-repudiation issue. Secondly, we've got a lot of technical problems that we're working on now, right? How do I know what malware is on your smartphone? How do I know that your device has not been compromised? How do I know that someone in the middle can't compromise the transaction of your ballot from you to the ballot box? How do I know the ballot box itself is controlled, right? This notion of the SSL and secure banking transactions, that's a huge misnomer, right? That's the vault vehicle, the bank armored car that's traveling. And the example I give is someone leaves $1 million of cash on a park bench, and the armored car comes along, picks up that $1 million of cash and takes it over to the bank and drops it off at the doorstep. The good news is that all $1 million was accountable for inside that armored car. But you have no idea what happens to that $1 million either before or after it is picked up and deposited. So there are technical problems in how we transact data across this particular form of internet. And I've been noodling in internet technology for 40 plus years. And I ask you to trust me when I say this internet was never designed to be used for what it is being used for today. It's a marvel that it remains standing. It has the longest uptime of anything in history. But be that as it may, there are technology research and development efforts underway to figure that out, because inevitably at some point, the ability to cast a ballot from a device in your hand is going to be something very desirous for generations coming up who will one day run our state houses. Today and for the foreseeable future, a paper ballot of record is essential, and the ability to control the anonymity, ensure the anonymity of the voter and the secrecy of the ballot remain obstacles to smartphone voting.
Thank you for that, Gregory. And Eric, I misspoke when I said that Eric, you were the only person on stage who hasn't actually spoken. Steve Crone, my good friend, has been quietly fuming probably in the last 5 minutes when I said that. Steve, I've left the best till last. Steve Crone, do you have a question?
Oh, no, I'm not fuming. The reason you didn't have me ask a question is because I left and came back. I guess I have one statement and one thing I'd like you to opine on, or maybe opine on both of them if you can. One very closely related to what you do, one less closely related. First, the idea that although we obviously want to protect voter participation and we want as many people who want to vote to be able to vote, the idea that voter participation rates necessarily produce better results, I think, is contested among political scientists. But that's a largely sort of theoretical question, but I wanted to ask it anyway. The second is, can you talk a little bit about what I see as a tension between the very important reasons why vote counting and vote administration are decentralized, even with standardized procedures, but decentralized, and the risk that that poses in terms of voter suppression, and the idea that these efforts to suppress votes in part can actually be a lot more effective because a lot of these efforts sort of place discretion at a very, very local level where who knows what can happen.
Thank you for those two questions. I'm going to respectfully punt on the first one purely because it's out of my lane. I'm going to recognize that it is a very important conversation that is contentious, this notion of participation and turnout and its effect on performance. To the latter, there's similarly some interesting issues here within another P of the five Ps of the ecosystem, right? If we think of the ecosystem of democracy as comprised of people, process, platform, which is the technology, policy, and politics, you're speaking to some really interesting issues of policy, politics, and process. You know, this goes back to the fundamental notion of local control or the notion of distributed control down to the lowest level, right? And so that's a political ideology to a degree, right? In federalism, it does, I think, produce a breeding ground for problems, as you observe. Our feeling, frankly, from a security standpoint, and I'll take it in a different tack direction because platform is our thing. We believe that central count, as opposed to precinct count, is the best and most safest way to do things, because when you so distribute your counting process as to taking it down to the precinct level, now you're asking for cybersecurity infrastructure to be replicated at tens of thousands of locations, maybe hundreds of thousands of locations more correctly across the country, with states whose infrastructure can't even really properly do it for one location, right? So as a matter of election security, we have a whole issue with that. And we like the Los Angeles County model, right, which is centralized count. Everything is collected up at the end of the day in each precinct and then couriered by escort of California Highway Patrol to the central office, where you have these giant high-speed, ultra-high-speed counters who then count the ballots. And, of course, then they can add in the absentee ballots, the vote-by-mail ballots, and then they have all the ability there for risk-limiting audits and recounts, et cetera, because they have their paws on the ballots, fortunately. So we like central count. In fact, I authored a rather extensive paper on our site about the concept of the proposal for manner of election security for a federal ballot that's vote by mail, that's centrally counted. Simplest ballot of all, right? Because the idea here being that we'll grant that the Russians probably don't care about the race for dog catcher in your local jurisdiction. So the security issues can be greatly focused and concentrated at the state level by doing central count. So that's our take on that issue.
Thank you, Eric and Steve. I'm sorry if I was, because I felt I was anyway, a little bit kind of unfocused in the general kind of thrust of the conversation. I know that Justin kind of questioned the premise of the room. And I am doing some work with Gregory. I am utterly fascinated, and I say this all the time, with Americans and their belief that Madisonian democracy equals democracy. And to the point that I think it could have been that you made, Roger, and I thought was a very good one, you know, that Americans should be skeptical of the whole process, you know, and to look at the detail and to stress test the detail. And I thought that was totally a fair argument. We've got to hold our electors up to scrutiny. So why don't we hold up the minutiae of the process to scrutiny? And I think that that is healthy. But for me, I always want to understand why America is exceptional. And I think as somebody who has great admiration for many aspects of American society, the fact that there could be a riot, an attempted coup, an insurrection, a disturbance, or a patriotic invasion of the Capitol building, which whatever you want to call it, that could happen is profoundly shocking. And I know for most Americans it's profoundly shocking. But for the rest of the world, it was unfathomable what happened. And not wanting to be disparaging to emerging democracies, but that's the type of thing we associate with emerging democracies. You know, so with that in mind and thinking about the year that we've had, I thought that framing the room thus with a deep skepticism that many Americans have for the system was a right and proper thing to do. But I take your point, though, Roger. And I did say this before, Aaron, I'll completely defer to you in a minute, sir, that there are many aspects of the American political system which can be drawn legitimately into question. I would say even down to, why do you need to register whether you're a Republican or Democrat? That doesn't happen anywhere else. Why do you need to say what your allegiance is? It goes on and on and on. And but anyway, this is not for me as a Brit who only half understands the American system to opine on a stage full of Americans. So Aaron, you're muted.
No, thank you, Wolfeld. Building off of that there a little bit, and then number one, I thought it was fine. I mean, maybe I just thought it was fine because I'm also a little bit all over the show, as my girlfriend would say sometimes. You know, the interesting thing is that, you know, the healthy skepticism is important, but we should also recognize that, broadly speaking, right, the people who question elections don't really question the elections that they win, right?
Exactly.
And I think that's an important...
Yeah.
What were we saying? And I'll finish.
No. I was just going to say, and that's the point that I made in one of my questions, that they only question it when their man or woman doesn't win.
Right. It's like, because, you know, when we were looking at the 2020 election, you know, only the... presidential portion of the ballots were considered to be, you know, needed to be reviewed, right? Completely forgetting that all of the other people running for Congress, for what have you, were on the same exact ballot, you know? And that's why when I see this stuff, it's like, you know, I have a hard time not drifting toward some kind of, you know, authoritarian bent, as what Eric Foster was alluding to there, right? It's because it's like, oh, well, I'm only going to question the stuff that I lose, right? Had it been like, all right, well, we should go and question every single down ballot thing because everybody was on the same ballot. I also think that that's kind of, you know, ridiculous. Maybe in hindsight there, but that would have been a little bit easier or rather consistent pill to swallow than just saying, oh, well, Trump didn't win. Well, we gotta question just the presidential counts then. It's this selective skepticism that really makes me curious about why the skepticism exists in the first place.
Absolutely. And we didn't mention, because we were taking 30,000 feet above the ground kind of like view, the fact that in a lot of these races where people questioned the ballot, there was a racial component as well. You know, these are urban voters. These were black districts. So let's question that. Let's question the integrity of those people who've gone out and done their civic duty and actually manning those voting stations. I want to have one last question before we end the recording of the podcast. And if people still want to continue the conversation, I'll leave the room open for another 15 minutes or so. But the title of the podcast and of the room is Do Dead Men Vote? Gregory, how do we know that dead men only rarely vote? I know you gave us a specific example before. As a percentage of the overall vote, what is this? You know, what is the level of fraudulent voting? So first, how do we know that dead men occasionally do vote? And then what, you know, what is the percentage of the overall vote which we know to be fraudulent?
I'll take the latter question. It's really infinitesimally small as a percentage. I mean, the studies have been done over and over again about that. I think in some of these last recounts, you know, and in something like 4 million ballots, we found four. But there are accurate numbers out there. I'm not going to be able to quote them off the top of my head. But considerable research has been done on this, and the number is infinitesimally small, like 0.0001% or less. But we know when there are problems if we have the correct, you know, checks and balances in the system, right? Absentee ballots have to have an attestation envelope in which they have a secrecy envelope inside, and then the signature is examined, and if it's approved, then that ballot is, that envelope is open. The other envelope is sent over the transom, and is now counted in a way that it's de-identified. But occasionally dead men do vote, it turns out, in four instances reported this week. And here's how that happens. The laws vary from state to state, but you had an individual who casts a ballot, right? And they've correctly requested an absentee ballot or a vote by mail ballot, whichever the case may be. And in these cases, they were health reasons. They couldn't attend the polling place. So they received their ballot and they duly marked it, cast it, signed their envelope, everything. But because they were hospitalized or they were homeridden, their relative had to take that ballot and turn it in, which they did. But something awful occurred on the way getting to the counting point. The person actually passed away. So the question becomes, does their ballot count? And if you counted it, did a dead person just vote? Query, as they say in major Eastern institutions. This varies from state to state, right? In some cases, no, if you're not alive at the day the ballot is counted, then your ballot doesn't count. In some other cases, so long as you counted it, you cast it when you were alive, the fact that you passed subsequently before it was counted is irrelevant. Those rules vary. But that is really the case of dead men voting.
Gregory Miller, thank you for coming on to Mid-Atlantic and fielding so many well-considered questions. But don't forget, folks, left of center politics, we always say here, is right-thinking politics. But we don't demonize our right-leaning brothers and sisters. We try and win them over with the strength of our argument, because that's what strengthens democracy, conversation and agreeing to disagree. Thank you, Gregory Miller. Thank you, Eric Foster, Ben Mendelsohn, Aaron Fisher, Roger, Aaron Berger, Dr. Dan, Steve Crone, Greg Sattel, Justin Higgins. And we also had Andrea with us and Dr. Francine Hardway, who I can absolutely recommend. If you ever find yourself in London and you fancy having a cup of tea, having one in Barnes with Dr. Francine and meeting her family is an ideal way of whiling away an afternoon. I had the great pleasure of meeting the wonderful doctor who's over from Arizona in London today, and I had a thoroughly agreeable time. We'll see you all again tomorrow, by the time you're listening to this, for another rip-roaring barnstorming episode of Mid-Atlantic. If you're in the audience right now, please give everybody on stage a follow. And specifically Gregory Miller, because we do want him to be able to come back onto the show, but also be a part of Clubhouse. So give everybody a follow. Also give the Mid-Atlantic Room a follow as well. And if you listen to the podcast, download the Clubhouse app, and then you can be part of a live recording of the show. I've run out of puff. And there you go. That's me, Roy Field Brown. That's been Mid-Atlantic. Take care. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.